Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Jason Stanley, professor of philosophy at Yale University, who examines Donald Trump's methodical assault on democracy that closely mirrors authoritarian regimes through history. Pastor Jamal Harrison Bryant, who talks about the nationwide 40-day boycott of the Target retail chain he's leading in response to the company's decision to end its diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. And Sushma Raman, interim executive director of Greenpeace USA, who discusses a fossil fuel company's $300 million lawsuit against her group filed in an effort to suppress climate protests and dissent. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Soon after U.S. President Donald Trump threatened to impose a 25% tariff on Canada and Mexico, Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau retaliated with his own $21 billion in tariffs. Trudeau, who had recently stepped down as leader of Canada's Liberal Party, lectured Trump, calling the tariffs dumb and denouncing Trump's bizarre threat to annex Canada as America's 51st state. Trudeau's tough talk on tariffs and defense of Canada's sovereignty against Trump has boosted Liberal Party prospects in the coming national election. For the first time in 3 years, the ruling Liberals have caught up with the Conservatives in national polls. Mark Carney, former governor of the Banks of Canada and England, was elected to lead Canada's Liberal Party on March 9th and will take over as Prime Minister until the next election. Carney is viewed as a fresh face with the skills needed to take on Trump in a trade war. The Conservative Party leader, Pierre Poilievre, is floundering, failing to come up with an effective response to Trump's tariffs and often parroting Trump-like right-wing rhetoric. The election, which could be called sometime this spring, comes as Canadian nationalism is surging, with popular support for boycotting American products such as liquor and wine, mass cancellation of U.S. vacations, and crowds regularly booing the American national anthem played at sporting events. As Trump's nominee to lead the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, Jonathan McKiernan faced questions from senators in a Capitol Hill confirmation hearing. The agency's acting director, Russell Vogt, was dismissing cases involving consumer complaints of fraud and unethical business practices. The cases dismissed against some of the nation's largest financial institutions documented charges against firms accused of illegally steering mortgage borrowers, issuing improper loans, and cheating depositors out of billions of dollars. The dismissed cases came as the CFPB, which has won $21 billion in awards for consumers over its 14-year lifespan, is now being systematically dismantled by Vogt and his allies as they move to fire 1,200 of the agency's staff. The dismantling of CFPB and the role of Acting Chief Operating Officer Adam Martinez is being scrutinized in a lawsuit known as National Treasury Employee Union versus Vogt. In court filings, current and former CFPB employees claim Martinez and the Trump administration are lying about its future plan for the agency. The CFPB has been under a stop work order after Vogt, who is the architect of Project 2025 and the director of the Office of Management and Budget, took over the agency. No work has been performed and employees are on paid leave that was characterized as a work stoppage to get around employee protections under federal employment law. A peace deal signed in Senegal could end one of the longest-running insurgencies in West Africa. The agreement between Ousmane Sonko, an opposition leader who became Senegal's prime minister last year, and members of the Movement of Democratic Forces of Casamance could lead the way to development in the impoverished, geographically isolated, and economically marginalized region. The deal announced in late February offers amnesty and a path to social reintegration for rebels who surrender their weapons. But security experts have noted that the agreement excludes a hardline faction. The conflict in Senegal that's killed 5,000 people and left 60,000 displaced since 1982 has been fueled by high unemployment, poor educational opportunities, and high levels of poverty compared to the rest of the country. The rebels have financed their insurgency by money made in the illegal trade in rosewood, an endangered hardwood, much of it exported to China, earning rosewood the name of conflict timber. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
Since Donald Trump was sworn in as president for his second term, the twice-impeached convicted felon, along with billionaire Elon Musk, have unconstitutionally attempted to eliminate entire federal agencies, fire hundreds of thousands of government workers, frozen the funding for life-saving programs here in the U.S. and abroad, and begun the mass deportation of possibly millions of immigrants. The administration has also launched a witch hunt to fire and defund any individual or institution that's ever worked to combat racial, gender, and other discrimination, or promoted diversity, equity, and inclusion programs. All this as they attack press freedom. Trump is also using his office for revenge and retribution by firing perceived political enemies inside the FBI and Department of Justice, while threatening to withhold federal funding to any institution that promotes policies he opposes. Trump and his appointees openly engage in corrupt practices, doing favors for Trump's friends, and recently blackmailing New York City's Mayor Eric Adams by conditionally withdrawing corruption charges against him, but only if he assists ICE in mass deportations. On March 8th, Trump ordered the politically motivated and unlawful detention of Mahmoud Khalil, a Palestinian Columbia University student and permanent U.S. resident, with the intention of deporting him because of his lawful participation in Gaza war protests on campus last spring. The move was temporarily blocked by a federal judge. Your reporter spoke with Jason Stanley, the Jacob Rawaski Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and author of How Fascism Works. His newest book is titled Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Here, Professor Stanley examines the many facets of Donald Trump's assault on democracy that clearly mirrors authoritarian regimes around the world through history.
It's a very fast progression towards autocracy, authoritarianism, fascism. You shouldn't bicker over the labels, but the United States is over as a democracy, and there's a slim chance that we could have the rule of law at some point in the future. But right now, it's just the president, Musk, and their cronies taking a hatchet to the United States, to its great institutions, the federal government, the universities, the economy. They're going to aim for Social Security, I suspect, but I don't know. But the media, of course, it's a frightening, horrifying, authoritarian attack of exactly the sort they said they were going to do, and the American people voted for it. So you're in a situation where the American people voted to end democracy and the rule of law and hand power to billionaires for tax cuts. And that's what they said they were going to do. They said they were going to target they were going to try to take us back to the past. Project 2025 spelled it out. Trump told us that he was going to target universities, target speech on universities and universities, target the media. And America, the American people voted for it. And if many of our large institutions, media, a lot of the media is normalizing it. It's a very clear for anyone looking, anyone with any international experience, it's just obvious what's happening. But, you know, you have folks like Brett Stevens of the New York Times cheering on what's happening, the attacks on universities. So, you know, it's difficult to see when the media is so complicit in the situation and normalizing what's happening. It's difficult to see how to put the brakes on this.
Professor Stanley, our listeners are aware that over this past weekend, Trump directed ICE agents to arrest and remove a Palestinian activist, Mahmoud Khalil, at Columbia University. He's a student there. Mahmoud was a leader in last spring's student protest movement against Israel's war in Gaza and was targeted for deportation before a judge intervened, blocking the move pending his lawyer's challenge to the deportation order. Just last week, the Trump administration cut off $400 million in funding to Columbia University, accusing the university of not doing enough to end anti-Semitism on campus, a charge that's disputed by many people at Columbia. That's included professors as well as students. Many Jewish students were, of course, involved in those Gaza protests. Trump recently posted on social media his intention to deport and arrest any student that engages in what he described as, quote unquote, illegal protest. In your article last fall, you talk about why fascists hate universities. Is this what we're seeing unfold with Mahmoud Khalil's arrest? And further, is this a test case to see how far Trump can go to suppress free speech on campus? And then, of course, he could expand that to all of us across the U.S.
Yes, to all of your questions. Let's note Khalil is still in a Louisiana prison, and his wife, who's an American citizen, is 8 months pregnant. So he's still under arrest. He's not being deported yet, and he has a green card. So it's completely illegal because he has free speech rights. We're also, it should be noted, hearing blanket silence. There was hysteria about free speech on campus in 2015, 2016 from various organizations like Heterodox Academy or people like Steven Pinker. Total radio silence about the most significant attack on free speech in universities in history, including during the McCarthy era. So it has nothing to do with anti-Semitism. It's complete cynicism. It is exactly what we've seen in countries like Russia, crackdown on the universities. Students are always the biggest protesters. So this administration is aware of that. Note that Trump, when he said illegal protests, they're going to punish any university who allows illegal protests. He didn't say about what? Any protests. Of course they were going to move past immigrants. They moved to federal workers, and no one cares. And so they're going to keep on going. Now they're going after, now they're going to go for student, continue going after student protesters. They're going to go after faculty. They're going to go after media. And they're going to continue to watch whether people care. And unfortunately, what I'm seeing is a lot of Americans not caring. And so they're just going to go category by category, targeting anyone they can target for their own personal profit until there's a much larger backlash than there's evidence of their being. And even then, it might be too late.
That was Jason Stanley, the Jacob Rawalsky Professor of Philosophy at Yale University and author of Erasing History: How Fascists Rewrite the Past to Control the Future. Find more analysis and commentary on Donald Trump's assault on U.S. democracy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Donald Trump's white supremacist beliefs, unconcealed during his 2024 campaign as he quoted Adolf Hitler and demonized immigrants of color, has been a central part of his agenda since taking office on January 20th. Among his first executive orders was a directive to eliminate all federal diversity, equity, and inclusion programs, the mass firing of all government employees who worked on DEI issues, and the revocation of President Johnson's 1965 executive order prohibiting federal contractors from discriminating in employment based on race, color, religion, sex, or national origin. In response to pressure from right-wing legal groups and Trump regime threats to investigate companies with DEI initiatives, dozens of Fortune 500 companies have ended their diversity programs, including PepsiCo, Walmart, McDonald's, Amazon, Google, Meta, and Lowe's. But the Target retail chain has stood out for having significantly backtracked on DEI commitments the store made in the aftermath of the 2020 police murder of George Floyd and the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement. Now, Target is facing a nationwide boycott led by black churches that was launched on March 5th. Jamal Harrison Bryant, senior pastor at the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Stonecrest, Georgia, is the national organizer of the 40-day boycott that he calls a corporate fast and a spiritual act of resistance. Your reporter spoke with Pastor Bryant, who talks about the Trump Republican Party attack on DEI and hard-fought civil rights laws, the demands being made of Target, and where the boycott may go next.
It is very frightening and disturbing for the African American community because of black people in total across the country spend $12 million a day at Target, or at least we did. They made a commitment to George Floyd's family to invest $2 billion into black businesses. This was outside of the scope of affirmative action or DEI, but in, as you're calling it, an anticipatory move, they dismantled their DEI covenant and the agreement to the George Floyd family and larger community. They are one of the largest employers of black people in the nation. And so we take this as a personal affront and a betrayal in no uncertain terms that you'll take our dollars but will not honor our dignity. And so churches all over the country are really up in arms and as a consequence are abstaining from any consumer relationship with Target, and they're feeling it because the shares have dropped by $12 a share in the last 30 days, and they've lost almost $2 billion in the last 45 days. So the impact is evident and undeniable.
Pastor Bryant, talk about, if you would, some of the other major Fortune 500 companies, many of them retailers that could be certainly vulnerable to a fast or boycott.
Yeah.
Talk about some of these other companies that may very well be in the crosshairs of activists in the near future.
We're setting our eyes on Walmart, the nation's largest retailer. We are not oblivious to Amazon's change of position. We're mindful of where Ford Motor Company is, where McDonald's is. And so all of them are under the microscope under these 40 days. At the conclusion, we look at expanding our reach and our focus to see where do we go next.
And Pastor Bryant, what has the company's response been to the organizing of this fast or boycott? Have they tried to reach out to you or to other pastors around the country that are part of the organized boycott here?
No, on last week, Target ascribed blame for their market losses and downward spiral of foot traction in physical stores and online. They blamed on tariffs and the economy. But Costco, who is in support of DEI, has seen no decline and actually is in the middle of an upswing. So, no, they have not reached out. I think that they were just hoping that the cloud will pass, but the storm is here.
Pastor Bryant, of course, one of your demands is to restore the DEI programs that Target CEOs had committed to, but that's not the only thing. Tell us more about the things you'd like to see Target as a responsible corporate citizen do.
We have four. The first one is that they will renew their covenant made to the George Floyd family of investing $2 billion for the development of black businesses. By virtue of the fact that the black community gives $12 million a day in sales to Target, that $250 million will be invested into black business, black banks, rather, so that banks would be able to afford access to capital for minorities who are trying to start businesses. Our target is presently on roughly around 27 college campuses around the country, none of which are historically Black colleges and universities. So we're asking them to adopt 10 of those Black colleges with business programs to help foster and to bolster business acumen in young men and women who are coming through the ranks. And the fourth one is DEI. We've named DEI last because the best kept secret in America is that Black people are not the number one beneficiaries of DEI. White women are. But we believe still has been the historic compassion model of Black people is that what makes America great is everybody gets a seat at the table. And so we still fight for those who are physically challenged and for those who are marginalized, being a part of the LGBTQ community. Our Latino brothers and sisters all ought to have a seat at the table, and we're standing firm on those four.
That was Jamal Harrison Bryant, senior pastor at the New Birth Missionary Baptist Church in Stonecrest, Georgia, and leader of the national boycott against Target stores. Learn more about the Target boycott by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In 2016 and 2017, thousands of indigenous people from all over the world and their allies came to the Standing Rock Sioux Territory in North Dakota to participate in a mass protest to stop the Dakota Access Oil Pipeline from being built through their ancestral lands. Before he left office, President Obama ordered the Army Corps of Engineers to conduct a more thorough environmental impact statement in December 2016. But as soon as President Trump was sworn into office the first time, in January 2017, he immediately ordered the pipeline completed. The company behind the pipeline, Energy Transfer, then sued Greenpeace for $300 million, charging that the big green environmental group had organized the protest. The trial of their slap suit, or strategic lawsuit against public participation, began on February 24th in Mandan, North Dakota, and is expected to last several weeks. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Sushma Raman, the interim executive director of Greenpeace USA, about her organization's role in the Standing Rock protest, the objective of the fossil fuel company's lawsuit, and the future of peaceful protest and dissent after the trial, whatever the outcome.
Greenpeace really showed up in solidarity when asked to by indigenous leaders and movements to support their efforts at Standing Rock. So we are just one of many players within civil society. There were over 100,000 people who showed up both from within the United States and around the world.
You've said that Greenpeace came to Standing Rock to support indigenous demands against the Dakota Access Pipeline, not to organize the whole thing. So why do you think Energy Transfer targeted Greenpeace with this $300 million lawsuit?
I'm still not clear why Greenpeace was targeted, but it's entirely possible that Energy Transfer was trying to send a message. And that is what slaps are all about. Strategic lawsuits against public participation are a tool that are increasingly used to stifle dissent, protest, and they target not just environmental groups, but also members of the media, advocacy groups, protesters, and so on. And it's a way whereby people are trying to silence, powerful actors are trying to silence critics and to send a message to other audiences. But we at Greenpeace are saying in response that we will not be silenced.
I imagine that also maybe they thought Greenpeace had deeper pockets than many of the other groups and individuals who came to Standing Rock. I know it's not all about the money, but the fact is that these lawsuits, which would result in devastating payouts if the defendants lose, is the source of a lot of stress. I wanted to ask what kind of support Greenpeace has gotten as a defendant in this lawsuit.
No, it's extraordinary the outpouring of support that we've been receiving. Hundreds of organizations and hundreds of thousands of individuals have signed our letter to energy transfer. The message is loud and clear. We had a week of action with folks joining us in Dallas, in San Francisco, in Washington, D.C., and online through our webinars, through our social media channels, where people are clearly saying that they will not be silenced, that they are joining with us to send a message to big oil. And what Greenpeace is much broader than just one organization or a set of entities. We are, you know, a movement for peace, nonviolence, for ensuring protection of the planet and the people. And that work will continue during and beyond trial.
So Sushma Raman, where do things stand in the trial right now?
You know, there's quite a bit of media coverage that people can research. And there's also some coverage that we've posted on the website and on our social channels that you can follow to get more information. But, you know, there was jury selection that happened at the beginning of week one, opening statements. And then we had the various witnesses from Energy Transfer. And at this point, the North Dakota Supreme Court has denied our motion to change venue. We anticipate that this might be done earlier than anticipated, but we don't know. Each day, things unfold slightly differently. I think that part of what we need to do as individuals who care about the planet, who care about communities affected by environmental and climate injustice, is that we have to be part of movements that are bigger than ourselves. And by doing so, we can really hold power to account, whether it is government accountability or corporate accountability. And so I firmly believe in the power of nonviolent social change. I believe in the power of movements that bring together folks across communities. I believe in the power of Indigenous sovereignty. And I believe that coming together, united, we will be a force to ensure that we will not be silenced.
That was Sushma Raman, Interim Executive Director of Greenpeace USA. Learn more about the possible consequences of Energy Transfer's $300 million lawsuit against Greenpeace by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFI in Ithaca, New York, WEFT in Champaign, Illinois, KMWV in Salem, Oregon, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.